Identity is spoken about so much in the media and in so many places. I used to be a school teacher, and this fragile thing is handed to each person as they grow, isn't it? Who am I? What am I? How does life work? And so we are coming to look at God's word, which is incredibly powerful on this subject. And we're going to look at some things from what David discovers in Psalm 8. Part of my story as well is that for 3 years I had long COVID. And for the first year I couldn't speak or stand or walk. But I was able to sit with the Psalms of Lament and drew through them, because I draw, and so this is one of the drawings from someone planted, the tree that's planted. You'll see it in the bookshop as well. It was made into a book, and it's just this whole life-giving, the life-giving word of God, and I pray that that's what we're going to discover this morning. There is a story that is told of two American hikers who were hiking around Scotland. They were walking on a walking tour. And as they went on their walking tour, they came across an older lady and a younger man. And they met this lady, and they were starting to talk with her, and they started to tell about their trip down to London, and they asked her where she's from, and she said, "Oh, I'm from London." And then they said, "You know, why are you up here?" And she said, "Oh, we have a holiday house just over the hill." And Balmoral Castle. And so the American visitors said, "So we have heard that the Queen sometimes walks around here. Have you ever seen her? Have you ever met her?" And she said, "I haven't, but Dick here," her bodyguard, he has." And so they turned to Dick and said, "Well, you know, what is she like?" And he said, "She is a bit cantankerous, like argumentative. She is a bit cantankerous, but she has a good sense of humor." And then the American visitors gave their phone to the Queen to ask her to take a photograph of them with this person who has met the Queen. And so she took the photo of these young men, and then she just very graciously gave the phone to Dick, her bodyguard, and said, "Can you take a photograph of us together?" And the guys were like, "Well, all right." So the photograph then was taken of the Queen and the two gentlemen. And as they walked away then afterwards, the Queen turned to her bodyguard and said, "I would love to be a fly on the wall when they show their pictures to their friends when they go home." Because they didn't know her name. They didn't know that she may have looked like this, but they didn't know that this was Elizabeth Windsor standing in front of them. They didn't know her name. And there's something about our name. There's something about our name that is very important, because it conveys so much about us. It conveys so much. Shakespeare, to get cultural for a moment, said, "What's in a name?" Well, Mr. Shakespeare, everything. Everything is in a name. And David has this time where he is looking at names. And at the beginning of the Psalms, he looks at names again and again and again. There are 14 Psalms at the beginning of the book of Psalms, which are in a family. And in that time, the amount of times that the word name is used is really quite significant. There's a beautiful bit where David runs out of words for saying what God's name is. He can't conceive of big enough words to express who God is. So what he does is he says, "You are not boastful. You're not evil. you're not wicked. And he talks about the things that God is not, because he couldn't conceive of big enough language to tell about what God is and how to communicate what he is. But for David, he spent a lot of time at the beginning looking at his name. The first 14 Psalms, so the first Psalm and the second Psalm are the trailer. You know when you have a movie and you have a short clip that tells you all the good stuff, sometimes too much, but tells you all the good stuff of what's in the movie. Psalms 1 and 2 are the trailer for the rest of the book. It sets out the pattern of what is going to happen. But the Psalms aren't some kind of untidy music storeroom. You know, in your church, before we went digital, there was a storeroom, and it had all the things kind of pressed in and shoved underneath and so on. The Psalms are quite amazing because they don't go in chronological order. They don't go in order of time. So we would expect it to be, you know, the shepherd boy and then Goliath and then so on, and to come through like that. It doesn't. Because the first psalm after the trailer of Psalm 1, 2, Psalm 3, David is already in his palace. He has a huge argument with Absalom. There's all of this detail when he is already established as a king. And then 9 is when he meets Goliath. So it is not in time order, which is quite interesting. But it's not in time order, and it's also not a dumping ground for emotion. Because often when we're meeting with people, we say, well, how can we help this person in front of us? And we look often at the Psalms and we're like, Lord, I need a hug verse. I need a verse that shows that you love, that you have compassion. And it can be like a little lottery, you know? It can be a little bit like we're looking for solace and for help. And that is good, but it is not just for that. It has been put together very intentionally with great purpose. And so we find from Psalm 3 to 7, there is this ache in David to come closer to God. It is shown in some of the words that are said in the different Psalms. We read of the holy hill, him talking about, I want to come close to your holy hill, far away. Then it speaks about the temple courts. Oh, he's closer now. And then it speaks about nearing the presence of God. So it moves like that. And then there is Psalm 8. And then from Psalm 9 to 14, it moves away from God until in 14, he's at the gates of hell. So that little group is quite significant and quite amazing. David, in Psalm 1, 2 is the trailer, but Psalm 3, his family is in a mess. There's unforgiveness, there is hurt, it's devastating. Psalm 4, there's been slander against his name. You know how important your name is. When somebody says something against your name, it eats you up inside. And you try and find the lie, and you're just playing whack-a-mole. You know, you're trying to push it down, trying to find the lies. And it's devastating. So, yeah. Psalm 3, it's unforgiveness and hurt. It's actually chronicling an incredible time in David's life where he didn't show forgiveness to Absalom for killing Amnon. It's a huge, terrible story. I think it's worse than Bathsheba, actually. If you look into the background of Psalm 3, it involves Tamar, his daughter, and incest and all sorts of things. But David didn't show forgiveness. And he's in this devastating place now that Absalom has raised up an army against him because he wouldn't allow him to come close, wouldn't allow Absalom to come and see him for 3 years. That's another story altogether. But yeah, I look into the background of Psalm 3, it's really harrowing. So that's where it starts, the Psalter starts. Then we're going into slander and rage in 4. In 5, others' lies about his name, kind of, obscure who he is. Psalm 6, his own sin blocks out the sun. Psalm 7, he's taunted. So again and again and again, we see David's name just being pulled apart. And he's distracted by slander. He's lost his family, his reputation, his throne. And here he is with this ache to get closer to God. And then there's this turn. I mean, it's quite striking that he's been on and on about his name. And then he moves to somebody else's name. It's a massive change, a shift. And as he moves to someone else's name, he moves to Lord, our Lord. How excellent is your name in all the earth? It changes. I get shivers with this. It changes. It completely shifts. And there's something about God's name and his identity that changes everything for him in this glorious psalm between 11 laments, right in the middle. And when we think about God and his name, how do we know who he is? How do we discover, even when we're looking in the Old Testament, what is the process of discovering who he is, what his character is? It's fascinating that as we look at the Bible as maids and princesses, as farmers and kings, as they encounter God, they name what they see. They name him. They name the experience that they have had and how he has met their need right there. So the first naming of God in the Bible is by a teenage pregnant girl who's running away from her abusive mistress. And what does she call him? The God who sees. She calls him Elroy, the God who sees. Because the experience that Hagar had in the wilderness where she wanted to die was that you are the God who sees, and she is named and sent back. And it's interesting, you know, that her situation didn't change. But now she was seen. And there's something about that, isn't there? That even when we are under dire circumstances, when we know that the God of heaven sees us, it changes something inside of us. It allows us to have strength where we didn't, gives us courage when we thought we were going to give up, when we'd written the resignation letter and we were done. But he is the God who sees. And then there was a young man who was hiding. Remember him? Hiding in the threshing floor. And what did he call him? He called him Gideon. Yeah, what did Gideon call him? Gideon called him Jehovah Shalom. He said, "You're at peace. That's who you are. I've got war all around. We've got armies invading, and here I am, and I'm experiencing peace in a place that there should be no peace." And he says, "You are our peace." And at every encounter with God, our understanding is expanded. You know God in a way that I don't. The person next to you knows God in a way that we don't. Because of the encounter. The most precious thing you may call God is Father, because that is who he has revealed himself to be. Or Forgiver. Gosh, that then is who he has been revealed to be. You know him in a way. And as we come together, the facets of how we know God and how we see him bring so much light to all of us, you know? Our understanding grows with each encounter, and we can teach each other about how they will find him in the future, you know? Yeah, because the experiences you have had with God can minister so deeply to others. So when demands overwhelm and we've run out of hope, we can lean into El Shaddai, the all-sufficient one. When the valley is shadowed and the darkness presses in, we can turn to Jehovah Ra, our shepherd, who walks with us through that valley all the way. And when we never imagine drifting so far from him, Jehovah Shema, the Lord is there. Even there, Psalm 139, your right hand, even there, the darkness is as light. He is there, right in the middle. And as we share our encounters with God, as we share that he is enough, that he is there, that he is sufficient, our strength grows, our faith is bolstered, is helped. One young builder in Nazareth showed us a new name, right? I have a friend who went to Israel a little while ago, and he was so shocked as he walked along the seashore that one little four-year-old shouted out to his father, "Abba, Abba, look at my sandcastle." And Andrew, my friend, he just thought, that is what I'm doing. I'm saying, "Abba, Abba, look at my sandcastle." And the father comes close and is in wonder with the child. It's so beautiful because Jesus' experience with the Almighty, eternal God showed us that he is our Abba. He is our Father. And we can come close. Yeah. Amen. Right, let's move on. Sorry, I can't see now. Okay. So we need to meet God as he has introduced himself in the Bible, right? Because we give him our own names sometimes, right? Which are not necessarily from encounters, but are from other places. We see him sometimes as a projection of our own thoughts. If I asked you the question, what do you think God feels when he thinks about you? That is a powerful question. That if you can use that in counseling situations, I've used it many times, and it allows us to unmask what is actually the Sunday school answer. What do you think God feels when he thinks about you? When you're thinking about your quiet times, your devotion times, your service, your all of these things, what do you think he feels when he thinks about you? I've asked that question in many different places. And do you know the overwhelming answer that is written on little bits of paper? He is disappointed with me. Overwhelming. Strong Bible-believing churches. He is disappointed. Why is that? Why do we think that? I think that one of the things that we do is that we just assume that God is a bigger version of me. I am disappointed with me. I think that I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I should be more this or that. And so what do? I project my feelings, and I put them onto God. And I say, this is how he thinks. This is what he feels about me. But do you know when you are maybe in a supermarket and a little boy or a little girl has taken a jar of honey and it has smashed on the floor? Yeah? What kind of responses have you seen from parents? What have you seen? I'll just do that quickly. Can I use this? Is that okay? Okay, so here's the jar of honey. It is smashed. It is all over. Oh, I'm in the artist network. I need to make sure this is all right. Okay, it's cracked. It's not very well drawn. And here it's a sticky mess. What kind of responses have you seen from parents? What have you done? What? Another one. Stupid child. Another one. Oh, what are they thinking? Listen to what they're thinking. There's a little cloud. Yeah. What are they thinking? Another one. It's okay. Don't worry. Yeah.
We can handle it.
We can
handle
it. Yeah.
Don't do that again.
I'm
so sorry.
Okay. How many times? How many times? There's a clock. How many times? I am sorry.
Hurry, let's get out of here.
Hurry, run. Okay. You have seen all these responses, yeah? The father will do whatever the father will do because of the character of the father, not the actions of the child. Yes? The father will do whatever he will do. This is what is in the fathers, these different fathers' hearts. They will do whatever they do, but it's not based on the child. It's based on the character of the father. And here's the thing. If we break the honey, if we smash the window, if we burn down the whole house, the father will do what the father will do, dependent on his character, not on our actions. Yeah? That is a life-giving thing, because we read that your faithfulness is new. Your compassion is new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. We know he is righteous and holy and pure. We're not taking away from that, but we know that he is love. He shows compassion to his enemies. We are seated with Christ in the heavenly realms. We have been clothed with righteousness and honor and so much. The Father will do whatever he will do, dependent on his character, not on my actions. And here we have something from Ryan. He says, the private images that we hold of God, often a projection of our, we'll get to that in a minute, have a powerful effect on our behavior. Private images have a powerful effect. Because if I thought that Terry was angry with me, would I go anywhere near him? I would go for the door. If I thought that somebody else was disappointed, I would get the next lift to go up to the expo. I wouldn't engage. And that has a massive impact on our relationship with our Father and on the people that we are helping, their relationship. Because, you know, in Psalms where it says, you thought I was altogether like you. And we do. We do. We think he's altogether like us. And that's the last bit here. They're related to images of ourselves. You thought I was like you. And I wasn't. I wasn't. My character is altogether different. This is the God I worshipped for, many years. I drew that in my 30s. It says, filled with potent possibilities of judgment. I worshipped a God that I was terrified of. Did as much as I could do possibly to distract him from judging me, you know? And it had a huge impact on my spiritual well-being until I met a godly man who I married, a godly man who showed me that there was another side to God, that he was a God of compassion, a God who pursued, a God who lifted and held, a God who had a future for each of us. It was just powerful, had a massive impact on my faith. And as he deconstructed the God of my imagination based on what I think what I thought that God should be like. As he deconstructed it, I didn't know where to look. And then I realized he was here all the time. And the God now that I worship and that I love is one who is a God of searing righteousness and holiness, but a God who welcomes and a God who comes close. Beautiful. Oh, anyway, let's keep going. Let's keep going on this. So he says, oh, Yahweh, God of the covenant, our Adonai, our master. How excellent, how majestic is your name. And he says, you have set your glory above the heavens. The heavens is not big enough to contain it. He runs out of words. It's bigger than I'd imagined. And that God reveals himself to us is beyond imagining, isn't it? And that he meets us in the darkest times is quite astonishing. So with this level of awe and wonder at the Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name, how excellent is your name. I learned it in the King James. How excellent is your name in all the earth. And you set your glory above the heavens. You would expect then there to be some way of proclaiming the greatness of God in a big way, you know, in a strong way, in something that's impressive, like fanfare and trumpets. And, you know, you're thinking, Lord, you need a better crew than these bandits that you're finding in threshing floors and teenagers. You need a Herod or a Caesar in your pocket. You need something impressive. And here David says, out of the mouth of babes, out of the mouth of, this is the plan, Lord, that you're going to show your glory in things that just make mess. What is that? Can I read you a little bit about this when I was coming across this? Let's see. Here we are. So I draw through the Bible. I think I mentioned that before. And so this is that verse. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength. So can I just read you a little bit? Oh, I need to go around this way, don't I, Steve? Okay. Out of the mouth of babes and nursing infants, you've ordained strength. This verse is a puzzle. It doesn't make sense. How does a baby show strength or give God praise? On their best days, they gurgle and give gummy smiles. They're characteristically cute. They're not impressive. Yet David says it is babies who silence his foes. But how? The clue to the answer is a few verses on, where the poet talks to God about the worth of a man. You have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. It is at the making stage that we're crowned with glory and given esteem. When God knits molecules and atoms and noses and toes, when he assembles our souls, that is the point that we are crowned. You have made him. So infants testify to God's mastery and design before they speak a syllable or lift a mic. David says that the transcendence of God is shown in the very fact that babies are here. Exactly what you're saying, Beth. That they have been built to breathe and to be. The Almighty displays his strength in the powerless. It's the theme that infuses the whole of the sacred text. And it matches the way that he spoke about his son. It was before the lad from Nazareth had done anything more than fix plows and mend tables that his father said he was beloved and that he took delight in him. God's very act of creation is the silencer. It undoes defenses. His genius is clothed in weakness, his strength in soft skin. Isn't it? I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? What the Lord, it's amazing. And it just took me all in wonder at that point. And I was just thinking, Lord, how excellent is your name that you have made and constructed and put people together. And we think you should have had a good PR team on this whole thing. You should have had a team that could have a branding and show and social media and all the things to show how great God is. And there he makes little ones who display his greatness. And also, you know, when we think of this, we think, well, Lord, you need big people. You need people bigger than us, more impressive, more godly, more prayerful, more filled. You need people like that to establish your kingdom and to tell people about you. And he says, I chose the weak. I chose the weak. That is what I did. That is the choice of God. And we are that. But his strength and our weakness come together to show glory and majesty. Absolutely beautiful. Do you remember when you first realized that God saw you? Do you remember that? My parents were both Christian leaders. We had impressive people in our house all the time, like famous people all the time. And they talked about big things. And I, as a little freckly kid at the bottom of Africa, was thinking, God is their God, not so much here, because I'm nobody. And I remember when I was 16 and we'd moved to Scotland, and I remember the Christian Union group in our school asked me to be the leader. That sounds so impressive. There were three of us. And I was the oldest. So they asked me to be the leader, and I said, okay, because I was the oldest, I had to. And I remember meeting with these two girls, and we prayed for a meeting that we invited students to, pupils to. And one of them said, God, we want 15 people at this meeting. And I thought, oh, you can't put God in a corner like that. You can't. We need to give him an out, you know, if it's your will. But, you know, so she said, we need 15 people. And then somebody said, we need hymn books. We need 15 hymn books for these 15 people. You know, so song books, this is before phones. We need 15 song books. And then the other girl said, Lord, one between two, one song book between two. And I just thought, you can't pray like that. You can't. And I remember going home that day, and my dad had come back from the Bible college where he worked. And there were some song books on the side. It was the little blue books called Mission Praise, and they were on the side. And I said to my dad, what are these? He said, oh, there were too many in the college. So I brought them home. And I said, well, can I have them? And he said, yeah, I don't need them. So I said, how many are there? He said, I don't know. So I went over, and I'm counting, and like my little heart is bumping, and I'm 10, 11, 12, 15 books. 15 books. And we went in and we had this meeting, and 15 people came. And I was just like, Lord, what is going on? You know? And at the end of that year, I remember coming, and there we were singing these songs, and I had been told to learn the guitar because somebody had to, and I was like, DGA, DGA. And we were at the end of that year, and I looked out, and we were in the sunshine sitting on the grass. And I looked, and people were sharing, and I thought, no, no. And I counted, and there were 30 people there, one between two. And I thought, Lord, I was so overwhelmed that it wasn't just my parents' God. He was my God. He saw, and he paid attention. Absolutely beautiful. And I think when we're working with people who are valued identically to us, are loved identically to us by the Father of lights, and we come and they say to us, but we're nothing. You're like, ah, not true. Let me show you that God is not a projection of your thoughts, that he is a God who steps in, doesn't step back. So it was just wonderful, you know, to see that he reveals himself to us. And David here in wonder, in absolute wonder, he says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? And you think, oh, are you going down there, David? No, 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 there's more to come. But he says, when I consider your heavens and the work, and he's in wonder. I came across an account of a scientist having a conversation with Theodore Roosevelt long ago. And the scientist called William Beebe, and he says, Theodore Roosevelt and I used to play a little game together. After an evening of talk, we would go out to the lawn and search the skies until we found the faint spot of light mist beyond the lower left-hand corner of the great square of Pegasus. Then one or other of us would recite, "That is the spiral galaxy of Andromeda. It is as large as our Milky Way. It is one of 100 million galaxies. It consists of 100 million suns, each larger than our sun." And then Roosevelt would grin at me and say, "Now, I think we are small enough. Let's go to bed." Isn't that beautiful? I think we're small enough. Now we can go to bed. We can rest all our concerns in the hands of the Almighty, who does that in that tiny little bit of dust that looks over there. Yeah. So after five laments that we've seen, where David has, that everything in him has risen up to praise the Almighty, he's found out that God is powerful enough to meet his fears, to answer his questions, kind enough to walk him through what he was going through in the past, in the future, in all, as we see again and again in the theology of the Psalms, that he's holy, he's merciful. So he sings uninhibited this song of creation. And then he moves on to his name. And what he sees here is really quite beautiful. So if you've got Psalm 8 open, then we're reading it verses 4 to 8. So here we are in verses 4 to 8. "What is man that you're mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? You've made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor." Can I just say those words again? "You have crowned him." Saying this to a king who has lost his crown. "You have crowned him with glory and honor. You made him to rule over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all sheep, oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fish of the seas." And here he is lifting his voice and seeing that before any job is given, before any achievement is made, before we get the office with the view or the resume or the CV, you know, of lots and lots of things, lots of people have said nicely about us. Before any of that, he says, "You're being crowned with glory and honor." Why, Lord? Why would you give us honor and glory? Because surely we'll just mess it up. Won't we? Just mess it up. Because he's heard all the things that we said. He's heard maybe last week when you told your neighbor, "You are so ugly." Or if you told your brother, you're so stupid. Or if you told the person next to you at church, "You're useless." Or if you told your friend, "You're pathetic." We do not say those things, do we, to people around about? There is somewhere we do say those things, though. We say it here. That is where we say those things, don't we? "You're stupid. Useless. I can't believe again." That is why we say those things. There's nowhere in Psalm 8 that God is preoccupied with our sin. That he is going through a list saying this and this and this and this. What he says is, I have crowned you. I have crowned you with glory and honor. That is your identity. That is who you are. That is it. And when we think of that kind of esteem, it makes us spin a little bit. You know, I have something in my room that helps me remember this. There are two things that I'm sure you have come across many times in your counseling people, helping them with their identity or with their growth. One of the things I've found again and again is people do not know who they are, but also they do not know who God is. Now, these verses tackle both of those things. I have in my room, attached inside of my lamp next to my bed, a little star. When I turn off my light, this shines. And I am reminded, I am crowned with glory and honor before the God who is above all. The Lord our God, how majestic is your name? For him, this is my identity. So I brought some stars for you to put inside your lamp. Inside your lamp when you go home. That you have it there, and when it shines, you can see I am crowned with glory and honor by the one, the wonder of wonders, the God of eternity. And he has said this about me. So who am I to contradict him and say, no, Lord, you got it wrong. I'm not that. Because he has said what he said about you. So this is for us to remember. If you need one for your friend, take one. I've got more. So if you need, or if you want to share that with anyone else, you feel free. There's a few. Help yourself. Yeah. So David is astonished, absolutely astonished before his God. So the reality then of our lives is that we have been given dignity and honor. We have been crowned with glory. That's kind of a little lower than the angels stuff, right? Just a little lower than the angels. And it's when we think about ourselves as small and why did you love me though, Lord? When we're doing jobs around the house, dusting, or I confess I don't do that very much, but you know, when we're just folding laundry, when we're brushing kids' teeth, when we're taking somebody to the bus stop, ordinary things, we've been given a place a little lower than the angels. So our shoulders can go back. And there's that beautiful part in Psalm 3 where it says, I am the lifter of your head. And the amazing thing about somebody lifting somebody's head is I can't lift your head from here. I can't do it. I have to come like really, really close. I have to cut. Can I do it? Oh, yeah. I have to come close. I have to cut my hand under your chin and lift your eyes. And that is the image that God has given. He is the lifter of our heads. Thank you. Even although we don't see that, you know, we don't see that we are worthy. He has chosen to set his love on us. And when we're tempted to feel that we're not important and that we don't matter, and that the things that we enjoy are insignificant and don't count, we need to think again. There is a Scottish runner, Eric Liddell. Chariots of Fire, have you seen that film? You know that beach? That is our beach. That is St. Andrews. That is our beach. That's where I live. And every year they have runners, you can sign up and you pay your money and everybody's dressed in white and they run the beach. It's beautiful, beautiful. But Eric Liddell was to go to China as a missionary and his sister said, but Eric, weren't you meant to go to China? And Eric said, yes, God has made me for China, but God has also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. Isn't that beautiful? He says, I have been given that ministry, but I'm also fast. And maybe you're fast, or maybe you're creative, or maybe you write, Or maybe you swim, or maybe when you're in the ocean, maybe when you're in the sailing boat. He's made us with these desires to fully enjoy the creation that he has placed us in, to open our eyes, open our hearts, worship him in all these different places. I swim in the sea in St. Andrews. It is cold. And I, you know that little way to pray, A-C-T? I don't know whether you'll know, no, you won't know this, but it's, you can teach children to pray with teaspoon, T-S-P, thank you, sorry, please. Yeah? A-C-T-S is adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication, asking. And I go along, swimming along, and I'm just like, Lord, what song is adoration? What song is this? And I sing it really loudly. There's nobody else there. And it's just joy. It doesn't have to always be linked with a hymn or whatever, but it's opening our eyes and our ears and allowing us to be the people that God has made us. He made me for ministry, yes, but he also made me fast. And when I do the things that bring me joy, I feel his pleasure. I feel it. There's you can breathe more, you know. So we are invited into mystery, into joy, into being able to worship wholeheartedly and fully. my mum kept on quoting this verse to me when I was in a dark time. My mum used to say this to me when I was bullied. And she's like, he who touches you touches the apple of God's eye. He touches the apple of God's eye. You are seen. You are loved. This is a reality. And we're going to finish off with a little bit. And it's C.S. Lewis. This is Psalm 8 as well. The moon and the stars, which you have ordained. But he says, there are no ordinary people. You have never spoken to a mere mortal. It says, nations and cultures, arts and civilizations, they are mortal. And their life is to ours as the life of a gnat, a flea, tiny thing. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, exploit. Not mere mortals, eternal beings made by God on high. And in chapter 9, in the next psalm, what David says is, those who know your name will put their trust in you. I think there's something about us each in this next year, getting to know God's name. Lord, show me who you are. In this situation where I am tangled, I don't know what to do. Show me who you are here, because you are here in the middle of this. Remember when I had long COVID at the beginning and I couldn't speak or stand or walk for the first 10 months, and I remember sitting on the couch and saying, well, Lord, here we are. What would you like to do with this? And I think sometimes in our situations, we forget that he's right there in the middle of it with us. Well, Lord, here we are. What would you like to do with this? It's not a punishment. It's not him walking out the door. He's in it with you.